Welcome, listener, to the Stuff Smart People Like podcast, featuring a panel of smart people discussing topics rather smartly. So let's go around the room and see who our panel is today. To my right is Ed. And Ed, why don't you give us a smart suggestion for the week?
All right, so I'm Ed. My smart suggestion for the week is this video that I found actually a little while ago. I'm not sure who did it, but it's called Star Wars Uncut, Director's Cut. And basically what it is it's a crowd-assembled remake of A New Hope. It's pretty awesome. I've only watched about 10 minutes of it. You know, anybody who's a Star Wars fan or a fan of, I don't know, odd projects of this nature, you can just search for Star Wars Uncut Director's Cut and find that, and I'll also put a link on the show notes for the podcast.
And it's a shot-for-shot remake, isn't it?
Yes. Sometimes it's very easy to tell what scenes they're doing. Sometimes it's not, because it'll be like some kids with trash bags on their heads. Like, you know, the varying quality of the fan films is what's partially entertaining about it. Like, one of the scenes is just a scene acted out in the ship at the beginning of the movie with a bunch of stormtroopers and Darth Vader and Princess Leia, and they're all like vodka bottles on a bar. Like, they just have like
that's awesome
on them. Yeah, and Darth Vader, when he's breathing, like, I think he's like on a whiskey bottle, and like the whiskey goes up and down like every time he breathes. It's like a stop motion animation. So there's some cool things there, but can I sit through 2 hours of it? I don't know. I'm gonna try. We'll see what happens.
Terrific. So the Star Wars Uncut is what it's called.
Star Wars Uncut Director's Cut.
Nice. To my far right is Jordan. Jordan, give us a suggestion.
All right. I'm actually going to kind of do a little bit of a shameless plug here based on something I'm doing later today. I think kind of people might have seen the movie Whip It back in the day. So I'm actually going to suggest people go out and see a roller derby match. They're kind of starting to make a comeback in these past few years, both men's and women's. Men's lagging a little bit behind the women's roller derby, but kind of really fun, and surprisingly, like, a lot of the guys, we have probably a surprising amount of, like, grad students on our teams, for the most part, and teams that we play against. So, some reason, smart people like to get on these teams.
Cool. So thanks for coming prepared, Jordan.
Oh, yeah. Every day.
Awesome.
And to my far, far right is Ben. Ben,
is that
give
a political
us a
reference? Is he, like, really?
I'm not particularly conservative.
No, I just I wanted to go with the bit that everyone was to my right.
Oh, okay.
Is that like that joke about Zoolander who can't turn left? Anyway.
I'm not an ambi-turner.
Yeah, right? Okay. Yeah, I have a smart suggestion, and this one kind of comes from a little behind the scenes about how smart people sort of works. And it's a website called If This, Then That. The URL is ifttt.com. And what's really cool about it is it ties together all kinds of different websites and social media things, and you can cause little triggers. So, for example, if I post something to a Tumblr page, it can also show up on Facebook. If I post something to Twitter that meets specific criteria, it'll also go to an email or a text message or all that stuff. And on the one hand, there's the ability for some of these sites to do that on their own. They can kind of tie together. But what's also nice about If This, Then That is that it's one stop, one control, and they're adding new sites and features on a pretty regular basis. So it's a really, really handy site to check out if you're at all plugged in that way, or you want to do things without having to visit four sites to get the same message out.
That's great. So it's kind of like a Gmail filter for your social media,
like,
right?
On steroids. It's really kind of cool, and it ties all kinds of stuff. You can send yourself a text message when someone retweets something from somewhere else. You can send Craigslist info to Tumblr. You can really kind of go crazy with it if you want. Yeah.
Ah, terrific.
Yeah.
And to all those guys far left is me, Dean. And my suggestion this week is a little website called Ukulele Underground, or Ukulala Underground as they pronounce it on the site, because they're actually in Hawaii. And it's just a place where if you goof around with a ukulele like I do, you can get some tips and lessons online. And they also have a school that you can pay for to get even more in-depth instruction. But it's good for, like, novice and intermediate players who just kind of goof around with an instrument, as I tend to once in a while.
Dean, did you also used to ride a unicycle?
No, I always wanted to, but I did do yo-yos. Anything
hey, that was fellow traveler, all right.
Anything that was outside of the mainstream in high school, I was definitely into trying.
See, something with ukulele underground doesn't sound, when you describe it, doesn't sound nearly as exciting as what I was imagining. I was imagining
the
a bunch of...
first rule about ukulele underground is you talk about ukulele underground.
Right. Like, they're getting together and doing some experimental ukulele stuff in a club, like taking opium and, like, I don't know.
Well, if they are doing that, I can't confirm it.
It's part of their meetups or something.
Yeah. Oh, well, the first rule of ukulele underground is you don't talk about ukulele underground. So, good place to go.
Right on. Good suggestions.
Dark, cold world out there. There's a time to live and a time for a man to die. There are places for dead men in the earth and the sky. Don't you venture too far now, 'cause you can't come back from the place where the good guys always dress in black. When you go to the old saloon at the Dead South End.
So what did, I wanted to talk about today for our main topic was the is a maybe a little known thing to most people. We in previous podcasts talked about the SOPA and PIPA stuff, which I think we can, you know, agree would affect a lot of people were that legislation to be passed. But scientists are kind of running into a similar kind of legislation called the Research Works Act. Before we sort of get into that, I think it'd be useful, since two of us here have had experience with the peer review journal process, to explain sort of how research gets done and how it gets disseminated to the public so you can understand why the Research Works Act sucks. So basically, and Jordan, you can jump in anytime you want here, mm-hmm. But the way that the academic process works these days, and I'm not sure how long it's been this way, is that anytime you do some work and you want to send that work out for people to see, you want it to get recognized, you want it to sort of count towards your academic record, you send it to a journal. And most of the journals that exist in the world are owned by private publishing houses. So you send your work to them. So you do your experiments, you write up the results. These experiments are often, not always, but often funded by grant money, taxpayer dollars. You send them to this private publishing house, you have it in this form that's ready for publication or almost ready for publication. They take it, and then they send it out for peer review, which is usually hopefully your peers. Sometimes it's graduate students, masquerading as their advisors.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, in general, yeah. Almost every grad student has done that. I can say I haven't done that. My advisor was much more scrupulous than most, but, they get busy. It's not paid, so as a reviewer, you're not paid. You just do the reviews, and you write up what you think about the paper, and then the editor, who is in charge of the manuscript, collects normally 2 to 3 reviews, looks at them, and determines whether or not these peers thought it was good. If they think it was good, they recommend it for publication. They usually give you some feedback on how to revise it, some things to, normally some language to add to qualify some of the things you've done, or some analyses to add, or things to look at. And then, a few months to years, depending on the publication, it gets published in this private journal. And then your peers can get access to it if they have a subscription to that journal. And usually most universities buy subscriptions to journals, but the average citizen wanting to go out and see some scientific work, they have to pay, or they have to use a university library or something like that. And what's great is that in recent years, the National Institute of Health, NIH, decided that any research that they fund has to be publicly available. What's interesting about this is that recently, they've come out with the Research Works Act, which it's just in early stages now, and it's endorsed by both a Democrat and a Republican in the House, I believe. And I'll read to you what the language is here. No federal agency may adopt, implement, maintain, continue, or otherwise engage in any policy, program, or other activity that, one, causes, permits, or authorizes network dissemination of any private sector research work without the prior consent of the publisher of such work, or, two, requires that any actual or prospective author or the employer of such an actual or prospective author assent to network dissemination of a private sector research work. So what that means is, even if you have NIH-funded money, right, or you have their money and you're using it for your research, if you publish it, then they're basically going to paywall it, right? So the NIH can't say, oh, yeah, you can have this for free, right, if it's published in their journal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, so let me just boil this down.
Yeah.
So previously, when you get published through an NIH-funded grant, mm-hmm. they will post it themselves in addition to that to make it available to the masses?
They will. They can do that. It's like that's their agreement. But it's usually published in a private journal as well. Like it's the right, same journal. Right. It's been published in a journal. And they take it and make it available on their website, and you can see it.
Right. And now the change is that they will no longer be able to do that.
The law would make it illegal for any federal agency to do that because it's effectively disseminating what they say is private sector work illegally. So there's this guy named Scott Aronson, who's a computer. I think he's a computer science guy at MIT, who basically he sums up the process, this whole process, in a very, I thought, appropriate analogy. So here's what he says. He says, I have an ingenious idea for a company. My company will be in the business of selling computer games. But unlike other computer game companies, mine will never have to hire a single programmer, game designer, or graphic artist. Instead, I'll simply find people who know how to make games, in other words, scientists, right, who know how to make research, ask them to donate their games to me, donate the research to them. Naturally, anyone generous enough to donate a game will immediately relinquish all further rights to it, which is true. You sign when you send your research in, you give it up the rights to it. From then on, I alone will hold the copyright, be the distributor and collector of all royalties. This is not to say, however, that I'll provide no value added. My company will be one that packages the games in 25-cent cardboard boxes, then resells the boxes for up to $300 a piece. Right. So that's basically what they do. They put it in these journals, and then they, if you want a personal subscription to it, it's very expensive.
Even the Institute, I guess, you know, one of the problems is people are like, oh, well, you know, whatever, they have to pay for content. And there's some, you know, argument for this kind of administrative cost. But the way they package these things is institutions can't just say, we want to get this journal, this journal, this journal. Like, they know they've got to buy, like, this package of, like, 500 journals.
Yeah. So
so this is basically just sort of like a major business move as much as anything.
Yeah.
And like when Ed said, you know, if you're not even affiliated with a university library, so I guess what would you guys guess you would pay if you just wanted to go to one of these journal sites as an individual, no affiliation with the university or institution, and wanted to download an electronic version of an article? What would you think you'd have to pay?
I'm gonna shoot high and guess like $3 or $4.
Okay, and Ben?
Are we talking about access to the site as a whole, or
just an article.
You want to download the most recent article that you read about in the Telegraph or something like that.
Okay. I would go with Dean. I'd say only a few bucks.
I've seen it before. Some journals will be like, okay, it's $27 for this article.
Oh,
wow.
An article.
Wow. To download an electronic version.
Right, yeah.
No. And what we're talking about is them privatizing publicly funded information, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That seems nuts.
You're effectively having to pay for it twice.
Okay, yeah. And the NIH funds a lot of research, doesn't it?
A lot of research, absolutely.
Ugh.
Subscriptions, if you didn't give them as part of like a society, so like a lot of scientists belong to professional societies like the, you know, like we would belong to maybe say the APA, and that would give you a subscription along with your, you know, yearly membership, which might be, you know, $150 or something like that, which you can normally get to paid for through like a grant or something like that. But still, it's totally a business move because they must be thinking that they're losing enough that they need to put a stop to it, you know, in terms of money. And then the last thing he adds in this analogy, just to finish it out, is, you know, why ever would these developers donate their games to me? Because they'll need my seal of approval. I'll convince developers that if a game isn't distributed by my company, then the game doesn't count. Indeed, it barely even exists, and all their labor has been in vain. And that's truly what it is. It's like, if you don't have, I mean, you hear people talking about researchers' caliber by where they're published, you know? Yeah. So he has a first authored publication in, you know, the journal Science, right?
Yeah, and so
right,
kind of like Wyatt's talking about this, you know, and the thing is, so journals, you know, in pretty much all the sciences, psychological, you know, social sciences and natural sciences, there's a thing they call the impact factor, and this is kind of what Ed's talking about. Kind of like, it's like this prestige factor. How much are articles in these journals recited, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, and like you said, like, that's kind of how your worth is based in academia is, okay, well, how many, you know, first author publications do you have in high impact factor journals?
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's there's no reward for going around this system, for making your research publicly available to people, because it's not respected as such. Because there, and it is true that, like, so the journals provide peer review, which is, you know, something that we hold valuable as scientists. And so, at Dean, we were talking about open science, and you said you didn't quite know what that meant. And what it means is there's sort of a push towards trying to publish in open access journals. So journals that don't, you know, that publish online and don't charge people to view the results. So you can go to these journals and you can see the papers. Anybody can. Even if the research isn't funded by, you know, a government agency, if you publish there, people can see it for free.
Right. Right.
Okay. Which is good for us, but the cost on that, they still have operating costs. The costs come on your end, so you as a researcher then have to pay them to publish your article.
So someone's got to make money somehow. The unfortunate part of this so far.
But it's not necessarily them making money; it's their overhead, right?
Yeah, well, because they have to stock editors and reviewers because they do the peer review stuff,
And servers to publish it, and so
there are. There are two basic problems with open access journals, right? You may or may not have imagined one already. One is that there are scam journals, right? Like that come out and say, because you now have to pay to publish your stuff, that there, you'll get emails. If you're a scientist, you'll get emails all the time, like, submit to our journal. Bentham's a good example of one. That is a predatory open access journal, and so much so that they know that they can get money from you to print your article, and so that's basically the reason they do it. They don't have a quality control process, as evidenced by the fact that someone submitted to Bentham's open access journal, paid $800 to get their paper supposedly reviewed, and it was a paper generated entirely by software. So it has no, so it says, you know, that software generates grammatically correct, context-free papers in computer science. So here's an example of what one of the, this is a published thing in an open access, this open access journal. In this section, we discuss existing research into red-black trees, vacuum tubes, and courseware. On a similar note, recent work by Takakashi suggests a methodology for providing robust modalities, but does not offer an implementation. Like, it's just complete nonsense generated, and it got published. And so there's the concern, and I had actually talked to you about this before, Dean, about some of these journals, is that people are concerned about the quality of the research published in them. So even if you go around this and you say, okay, I'm going to only publish in open access journals, people might not value your work because they think, so the big one.
Because it's the Wild West.
Right. Yeah. Basically. And you're paying. So, we're talking about having something published. If you want to get published in the Public Library of Science journal, which is one of the big open access journals now, you're charged $2,900 to publish it.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah. Plus one, which you, and plus medicine, which you will, that's for plus medicine. For plus one, so Public Library of Science is where the plus comes from. it costs an author $1,350. And so it's really expensive, but at the same time, there's like, well, I paid to have this published. People kind of wonder, like, is the editorial process less strict? And I've heard people say that, you know, a professor that I work with, I've heard say, you know, that basically it's a vanilla peer review process. So if you have a paper that's been kicked around to other journals and they reject it a bunch of times, you can go to plus one, pay, and have a smoother process of getting it published.
On the one hand, you're paying you as the reader are paying exorbitant fees for seemingly no reason to read something, or you as the submitter are paying exorbitant fees to get a potentially less rigorous and less respected position.
Right. So I don't know. I've read a lot about people's ideas of how to fix this, and it's pretty sad. But I do think that this Research Works Act is pretty evil. I mean, when you're trying to write a paper, you try to read other research, and a lot of times your university won't have a subscription to the journals you need. And so sometimes people are left with the question of like, well, do I try to get this through other means, or do I just not cite this work or not read this work that might be important to what I'm doing?
Or do you cite off the abstract?
Right. Yeah. Or do you cite off what you can get as the abstract, which
that's
is not
risky,
recommended.
Isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Don't lie. You've done it before.
I've seen it backfire actually. I've seen students write papers that I've had to look at, and I knew the research they were citing, and I knew they were citing just the abstract.
Can you explain what the abstract is?
Sure. So the abstract is basically like a blurb about the paper that's supposed to give you a gist of what is involved in it.
Jacket.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that's a good way of describing it. And so it necessarily dumbs down and leaves out details. And a lot of times people are just looking for a quote like such and such 2000 whatever said this. And you can just go in the abstract and you can see that, oh, they say they found evidence of X, right? But the details of what that evidence are and whether it's good evidence or whether most people would interpret it as such, you can't see because you can't get to the article. And so they just cite, or in their case, a lot of times it might just be laziness. I don't know. They just don't want to go through and read the whole thing. They just want to get their paper done for their class. I had a student turn in a research paper that actually cited some of my stuff. And it was clear they had not read what I had done. They had read the abstract. And I mean, there's just not enough room in the abstract to tell people what you actually did and what you found. You have to sum it up. What's the APA limit? Is it like 120 words for the abstract?
No, I think it's more than that. I thought that was maybe like 150, 180, something like that.
I don't know, but it's still small.
It's still less
journal,
than 200.
Yeah, journal by journal, it's...
This
it's,
is often a huge
it ranges
study.
It between 150 and 250.
You're talking about results maybe of a study that's been going on for years or a semester, or it has multiple facets and lots of things going on and lots of things tested.
Yeah.
And you can't fit all that into the abstract. But the abstract is available for most of these journals. You pay for the full text or the PDF of the article, but you can see the abstract for free. So that's what Jordan's talking about. The real evil group, I think, or the group that most people have keyed in on this is a Dutch publisher called Elsevier, who publishes things that we mentioned, The Lancet, before on the podcast.
Okay,
they published
yeah.
The Lancet. That's like their most popular journal. But they have many, many journals, like 2,600 journals or something like that. And they have – it's come to light recently that they've made – large contributions to many of the people who are supporting this bill. So one of the other things that, and so there's a big with the Elsevier in general, is that they seem to be the target because they're so big, and because they seem to be funding a lot of this legislation. There's a big thing going on with people boycotting it, like signing a petition. Scientists, working scientists in all fields. Psychology is not well represented at this point, but they're deciding they will not review for any of their journals. They will not publish in them, which is a big thing to say because, like I said, there are some huge journals that are huge impact factors that could help people's careers if they published in them. Not that they necessarily could get published in them because they probably have high standards, but like The Lancet or Neuron or Cell, like those are all their top journals in Elsevier, and those are huge in the community. And like Jordan said, they have a high impact factor, meaning it's a combination of a variety of things, like how much exposure your work gets, but also how much it gets cited and who sees it. So, the more people that subscribe to it or get access to it, the better. But they also have this sort of pay cable model where they say you can't just like look at a year's worth of downloads and say, okay, we're only going to subscribe to like certain journals. from you, like we only want your top five journals and we want to pay those subscriptions, you have to pay for a bunch of them. Like, so I found this guy was doing an analysis of these things, and I'm not sure what university he's talking about, but he says UCL, whatever this university is, pays Elsevier an astonishing sum of $1.25 million for access to his journals. That's pounds, actually.
University College London.
Oh, yeah. Not pounds. I'm sorry. It's euros. So that's actually twice, right? Isn't the conversion twice as much?
It's more like one and a half, but yeah.
One and a half. So it's over $2 million US. And that, you know, that doesn't include any – that's just electronic access. That's just – you know, you don't get print editions. And, you know – the University College of London buys a package that has 2,100 journals of their 2,700 that they publish. And they go through this analysis, and it's ridiculous. It's like 56 of them were never accessed in 2010. 56 of the ones they subscribed to were never accessed by anyone at their university.
So who gets this money?
They do.
It's just the journal company, the publishing house,
which is why they can afford to fund legislation.
Right, and I guess that's what I was asking. Like, where does that money get filtered to once it goes to the publishing company? Like, is it just CEOs and exorbitant fees of that for salaries for them, or because it's way more than overhead? Right. Because if it was overhead, it'd be pretty cheap.
Right. And they don't have to pay any of the, they don't pay the scientists. They pay the editors not very much. I mean, having experience with people who have been editors for journals, it's something that looks good for you for your career, so people do it. But the amount of work they put in each week, or, you know, what they call refereeing manuscripts that come into them and picking, you have to, you know, every time an article comes in, you have to look at it as an editor and say, okay, who can I find to review this? Who can I contact who would be an expert in this area and could comment on this? They do a lot of that work. Then they make decisions, write decision letters, and they make, you know, a few thousand dollars a year to do this. And they're doing, you know, they're putting in hours and hours a week to do it. So they're not paying. It's not paying down to them. It's still staying at the higher level.
Right. And again, it's all donated work.
Yeah, exactly. I can remember, like, when I published my first article, I can remember signing the like copyright thing, and I was thinking, like, this is weird. Like, this is my work. And even if it's not my work, it belongs to my university because I work for them. But, like, I'm now telling this private company that they own it, right? Like, they didn't do anything except decide to publish it.
And it's actually pretty unique. As far as I understand, even in publishing in general, a lot of times if someone, for example, contributes something to a magazine or something, they retain some rights to it. Usually that magazine gets, like, you know, sort of like a first publishing right, or there's a certain kind of, like, window in which they get to sort of control it. But after that, it reverts back to the author. And does that ever happen with your academic work?
As far as I understand, no, it doesn't.
Oh, jeez.
Nope. Yeah.
People can contact us individually, and we can kind of send it out ourselves.
You can actually get in trouble for doing that, though. Like, not that, you know, it happens all that often, but, like, say you you published in some journal and you have a PDF copy of it. They do give you a copy that says, like, for sort of personal distribution, so you can send copies of it to people or whatever, but it's real iffy. Like, if you put it on your website
and then you're basically broadcasting it, right,
and that would effectively, and that's why that second stipulation in the bill says, you know, the author can't basically do it either. It would be illegal, and I think it's already illegal, but I guess they just threw it in for good measure. But yeah, it's a strange model, and I don't, it's a weird idea, even, like, because as scientists, and not all scientists necessarily share this idea, but I think a lot of scientists anyway believe that they're trying to uncover truth, right? So there might be some postmodern scientists who are like, oh, it's all not that objective, but they shouldn't really be scientists, in my opinion. So it's, like, weird that they can own truth, right? Like, you find out something about obesity, say, right? And you find that, you know, something might help save people's lives. They own the right for you to know about that, right? Like, about truth. Like,
right,
that's a
information, as it were.
Right. Like, if it, and you know, we have all these codes as scientists. Like, if you're doing a trial, right? Let's say you're doing a trial of a drug to reduce obesity or something like that. You do these tests during the trial to test the effectiveness of your intervention. And if at some point you realize, like, this intervention is very effective, so much so that it would be unethical to continue and not give some people in the study this drug, right? You need to stop your trial and start administering it in like, and because the basic idea being that you have knowledge that you're withholding from somebody that could save their life. That's kind of the same thing. They're just withholding this information so they can make a profit off of it. And it's not overhead at all. So, I mean, I think the open, if the open journals, you know, it might be one of these things where they start out, there's a lot of them and they get sort of culled into some better journals. And you start to know that like, okay, I can trust X because I've worked for them, like I've done reviews for them or whatever. And they seem to have a good process. They have good people being editors and things like that. Maybe then it's not a big deal because part of your grant money that's coming to you is funding the publication of it. So you're paying, you know, you're paying that. It's not going to be out of pocket to pay that. I forget what number I said before, $1,350 or whatever to get them plus one. Mm-hmm. It'll be coming from the grant. And so in that sense, the people won't have to pay twice to read it or to do it. And it's not coming directly out of your pocket. So maybe that's a better thing. But right now it's kind of, I don't know if it was Dean that said it was the Wild West or remember who said it was the Wild West. That. I think that's an accurate description. And so maybe it's just in its sort of infancy right now and it needs to improve. I don't know. But at this point, like, I don't know. I don't have the money to submit to an open access journal like that. And there's, I don't think I would get much respect on the job market from people like saying, oh, he has a first author and plus one. I don't think that would cut it. So I'm sort of stuck in this system as it is. So, yeah.
Well, there is something to be said for someone choosing your work rather than you paying for it to be chosen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an argument to be had there. It's just that if you like go through the whole process and you find that. You know, never mind. We've already made this point. So
yeah,
let's not
belabor it.
Well, yeah. I feel that I don't think that the public knows at all about this kind of stuff and how this goes on. I mean,
well, I don't know if a lot of people really know how much like that research and publishing really influences. Maybe not necessarily what happens to them or with them right now, but those journals and that publication and that research that you do does inform, you know, medicine and psychology and, you know, whatever else you're studying.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually people will see those results. And if certain information is kept from either the public, who can also do their own review, mm-hmm. And a certain array of, members of the of your field, mm-hmm. then they're worse off and don't have all the necessary, relevant, up-to-date information.
Right. The only person making out in this situation is the publisher and the Congress people who has
like the least obligation to help anyone. Really.
Well, actually, yeah. And if they looked at, I think it's actually the Democratic House representative that's spearheading this.
Yeah. Or one Maloney, of them, I think is.
She's got a ton of donations, campaign donations from publishing companies. It's one of her major campaign donors.
She's had 12 from Elsevier alone.
Yeah,
and including her largest of her donations was from Elsevier. And
yeah, so if anyone is living in New York, if there's anyone who wants to write to Carolyn Maloney about the fact that she's kind of being a D-bag,
include that in the letter.
Go ahead.
Right? Yes. All right, gentlemen, well, let's lighten things up a bit. And we haven't had a game since two podcasts ago, so I decided we should have one this time. As you may or may not know, there is a big game going on this weekend between the New England Patriots and the New York Football Giants called the Super Bowl. I hope we don't have to pay for those rights. And what I decided was we should have a contest here, and we should compare these cities, have questions about each of these cities. So we're going to just assume that New England is in Boston, because most people do, even though they play closer to Rhode Island. We're going to just say that they're in Massachusetts and that they are a Boston team. Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Yep. Sounds fine.
Okay. So then we're going to go in order of geography. And in the break, we figured out that, you know, west to east, we are located as such. Ben, Jordan, and Dean. Ben being the furthest west, Dean being the furthest east, although the degrees are not as great as you might imagine. So we have three categories. We have history, education and science, and sports. So we're going to start out with history. Ben's going to go first. I have three questions, and you can choose. We'll do the ABC thing again. So okay.
There's no other criteria I can pick between.
No, I don't, and I didn't order them in terms of difficulty or anything like that. I didn't think ahead to do that. So, yeah.
All right. Well, in that case, then Ben starts with B. So let's start with B.
Okay. All right. So here are two events in each city's history. Okay. And I want you to tell me which one claimed more citizens' lives. So Boston Massacre.
I'm starting happy here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Big, yeah. It'll really pep it up.
Yeah.
The Boston Massacre, and in New York, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire.
Oh, I'm going to go with Shirtwaist Factory Fire.
You are correct by roughly 141 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Boston Massacre was 5 deaths, and the Shirtwaist Fire was 146. So I think technically the massacre might, depending on who's doing the shooting, count as a mass murder instead of a massacre. But
no, it was a group of soldiers.
Oh, so they couldn't really tell. Oh, well. Well, we'll call it the massacre, but it was much less intense than I previously thought.
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah,
Jordan.
Someone wasn't listening.
But no less historically significant.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, yeah. Jordan, A and C, yes.
My name starts with neither an A or a C, but I have been called an asshole before, so I'm going to go with A.
Okay, asshole. which city was settled first, New York or Boston?
I'm going to go with,
a lot of dead air.
Yeah, I know. It's like, yep. I'm thinking New York.
Pin drop.
You're correct. By Woo! 6 years, New York was settled in 1624 and Boston was settled in 1630.
Wow.
Well done. Yeah. Now, Dean, you are left with the final question.
I'm going to choose C.
Okay.
Bold choice.
Okay, from 1774 to 1800, Congress met in several locations, and therefore 8 cities can be considered to once have been the United States capital, other than Washington, D.C. So which of the following is true? Both of these cities, Boston and New York, have been the capital at one point. Neither have been the capital at one point. Boston has been and New York hasn't, or New York has been and Boston hasn't.
Wow, that's tough. I am going to say that neither have been.
Oh, you're incorrect. New York was actually the capital twice because Congress met there between January 1785 to autumn of 1788 and from March of 1789 to, I think I have here, December 1790. So somewhere in those few months between that, I guess we didn't have a capital. But New York was it twice. Boston never was it.
Okay.
Sorry, Dean, that you had like the 4-point multiple choice rather than the 2-point that Ben and I got.
Yeah, really.
Hey, there. Is all the luck of the draw.
I guess that's true.
I think most of the rest of them are 50% probability questions. So, all right. So now we're on to education and science, and Ben gets to pick again.
All right. Well, I did so well on B the last time. Let's do it again.
Okay. As from our previous discussion, which city as a whole receives more grant funding from the National Institute of Health, Boston or New York?
I know this one.
I have a feeling it's going to be Boston.
Is that your final answer?
When you do that, yes.
You are correct.
Yep.
1.6 billion versus 1.2, which when you consider the difference.
How much did Harvard and Mass Gen get alone?
That I do not know, but a lot.
And MIT and, anyway. Yeah. Well, that's it. In Boston,
the relative difference of the size and population, though, you think there are, you know, maybe more universities, but yeah.
I was almost ready to give in because it's like, well, on the other hand, New York is just, you know, millions of people and millions of, or many, many students and universities and all that, so.
True.
Nope. Can't fool me.
Jordan?
All right, I'm going to go with C.
C. Okay. Keeping with the university theme, which university has a larger student body? This includes graduate students and undergraduates. Columbia or Harvard?
I'm going to go with Harvard.
You are incorrect, sir.
Oh, really?
Yes, Columbia has... exclusive. Yeah. Harvard has 21,225. Columbia has 27,606.
Oh, okay. I thought the grad student thing would have...
Yep, that's why I threw it in there. That's called a distractor, folks, in testing. Dean, you get the last question.
Yeah, I choose A.
You choose A. Okay. I didn't realize in this situation that you really kind of got screwed on the choices. But I think you're going to like this one. Which state received a higher grade from the Fordham Institute for its science standards for school children, Massachusetts or New York?
Well, I'm going to say Massachusetts.
You are
because correct. They are pretty liberal, and liberals like science.
Yes. So
that's true.
Yes, you are correct. They got an A-, and New York got a B+. So it's close. And what's interesting is that the rest of the country basically failed, except for California and a few other states. I believe our home state of Michigan got a C on the report card.
Hey, that's average.
Many of the plans shoot for the stars.
Not in great inflation.
Mediocrity.
All right, gentlemen. Jordan's Ben's the one to beat here. Jordan.
Yeah. Ben
has two. Jordan and Dean have one each. So we're on to sports, and Ben, you have the floor.
Well, thanks. I have the floor, don't I? Well, in that case, then let's change the subject. No, I'll go with C this time.
Just C. Okay.
Just to spice things up.
This is a true or false question. True or false, the New England Patriots were once known as the Boston Braves.
False.
You are correct.
Yeah, what's up?
It was baseball, wasn't it?
Yeah, Boston Braves. Yeah. Boston Braves were...
Guess what? You're baseball. Wrong about that. Oh. Boston Braves were actually a football team. They were established in the city in 1932. They changed their name to the Boston Redskins the following year and relocated to D.C. In 1937. The Patriots weren't created until 1960. Well,
there's also a baseball team named the Boston Braves.
Ah, look at that.
Yeah, so how about you?
So we were right.
That we're wrong.
We
would like an apology.
I read the Boston
Wikipedia a formal apology.
And I didn't
a
see the Boston
apology.
Braves. But you might be right.
No, I'm right.
Might be? No, I think...
Babe Ruth retired as a Boston Brave.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I did not know that. I apologize. I rescind my... Now, Ben cannot be beaten, actually, but we'll just
finish this
out.
Bulletproof.
Maybe we'll have a lightning round at the end. I don't know. Jordan.
Yes?
Your chance at 2 out of 3. Do you want B or C? Or no, A or B, sorry.
I'm going to go A.
All right, this might be a good one for
you.
Asshole
one.
Okay. If you add together all the championships won by all four sports teams in Boston, so this is the Red Sox, the Patriots, the Bruins, and the Celtics, okay, all the championships, would that total be greater than, equal to, or less than the championships won by New York baseball teams?
Oh, wow. The Yankees won a lot, but then the Celtics had a really good run. Bruins. Actually, I'm going to stick with Boston. I think between, you said the four major sports teams, right?
Yes.
So hockey.
So Red Sox, Patriots, Bruins, and Celtics.
Oh, man, I think it's probably close, but I'm going to say that they've won more.
You are incorrect.
Oh, God damn it.
So,
Yankees have won, what, 27?
Yes.
And then Brooklyn counts probably, and they won a few times.
One.
And the Mets have won
twice. Yep.
Yeah, and the Giants also. Did they win any?
Yes,
but no, he said only the baseball. Oh,
the New York Giants were a baseball team. That's why the New York Giants are called the New York Football Giants because distinguished
stipulation.
You thought he made that up? Yeah, it's not true. So yeah.
Damn you, Chris Berman.
Yeah, see, he's being accurate. sort of like when people say the Ohio State University, as annoying as that is.
That's their name.
All right, Dean.
Dumb.
A world of possibilities here.
I will choose B this time.
Okay, B. All right, good choice. Which soccer team has been to more MLS Cup title matches, the New England Revolution or the shamelessly named New York Red Bulls?
Actually, I'm going to break in here. I think you're kind of implying an answer in there, and I think the correct answer is C, who gives a fuck?
Soccer gets no respect.
Wow.
Oh, sorry.
Well, MLS, I mean.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, they're kind of the laughing stock of the soccer world.
I'm going to be patriotic rather than, even though I know corporations are people. And I'm going to say that the revolution is the answer.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Interestingly.
Is Prince on that team?
Neither of the teams.
Yeah, Blackjacks.
Anyone gets that.
Shirts versus blouses.
Neither of them have ever won. New York has been there once, and New England has been there four times and has not won. They actually went for 3 years in a row from 2005 to 2007, lost all three, including the last two, to the Houston Dynamo. So, yeah. Uh-huh. So
kind
much
of the
like
Buffalo
the
Bills of,
yeah, I was gonna say the much maligned
of football.
Bills. Yeah, of football. Yeah. Yeah. So, so how did we do, folks? Well, Ben is perfect.
Yeah, I slam dunked. I was.
Yeah. Jordan and Dean are tied for second. So if you guys want, we can do a tiebreaker to see who gets second and third.
I think we're gonna have to.
Yeah.
Yes, for pride's sake. Well, Dean mentioned Massachusetts being a more liberal area, and so. Here's your tiebreaker question. What percentage of Bostonians identify with the Democratic Party? Let's see, Jordan, let's give Dean first in this.
Are we going to straight up closest to?
How about this, Dean? You can go first or you can defer to Jordan, and you can, it's going to be first, it's going to be closest to, just closest to. I don't want to do without going over because you'll just screw each other. So.
Okay. $1.
We're still going to do that. I'll defer.
Ooh. Okay. 63.
Okay, Dean.
49.
Oh, okay. Now I got to do the math here.
Uh-oh.
The true answer is 55.04%. And I think that means Dean won.
I think that's correct.
My math is terrible, but I think he was six away. Roughly, Jordan, you said 63, so you were 8 away. So Dean wins, and he didn't go over. So,
well, I
congratulations,
you know what I did.
You're the first loser.
So that'll wrap it up for another edition of the Stuff Smart People Like podcast. Be sure to check us out on the blog at stuffsmartpplike.blogspot.com, on Twitter at smartpplike, or Facebook and Google Plus. Coming up on our blog, we have our charity voting for the charity that we're trying to affiliate with, which ends on the 15th of February. Soon we'll be having an Oscar contest where you can submit your picks for a chance at a prize. That'll end on midnight the 25th, right before the Oscars. And we'll also be live tweeting the Oscars with the hashtag SmartyOscars. So until next time.
I'm Ed.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Jordan.
And I'm Dean for Stuff Smart People Like. We think it's smart, so should you.